Welcome to episode 7 of the DeFi Sparks podcast. I am Nick Dracon, and I created this podcast to facilitate conversations with some of the sharpest minds in DeFi around topics that I happen to be curious about. The podcast is brought to you by Revelo Intel, which is a startup that I recently founded. We're building a platform that will focus on providing tools and information to help people research their favorite Web3 applications more efficiently. We aim to launch in the next few months. Now, today I'm talking to Eitan Katz, who is the founder of Kima Finance, a utility-specific blockchain that aims to act as a settlement layer in a chain-agnostic world. Put simply, they're working on the distributed ledger technology interoperability problem set. So basically, moving assets cross-chain. Now, Eitan has been working at the cutting edge of technological innovation for over 35 years. He's a pleasure to talk to, not just because of his wealth of knowledge and experience, but also for his talent in unpacking complex concepts in ways that everyone can understand. Today's topic is, of course, DLT interoperability, distributed ledger technology interoperability. We start with defining the concept and discuss why it's such a difficult problem to solve, or why it's proven such a difficult problem to solve. We discuss the risks associated with current solutions for moving assets between chains, such as bridges, which have been in the news recently for all the wrong reasons. We dive into the idea of universal liquidity across chains and what the implications are of achieving such a goal. Finally, we ponder a world where off-chain liquidity can seamlessly merge with on-chain liquidity. Now, a reminder that if you enjoy this podcast, please consider leaving a review on whatever podcast platform you listen to, or subscribing to the channel if you happen to be watching this on YouTube. Now, let's get to the discussion. Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen. I'm here with Eitan Katz, who is the founder of Kima Finance. Thanks for making the time this morning, Mr. Katz. It's a pleasure to be with you.
My pleasure.
And the topic for today revolves around distributed ledger technology interoperability. I always have difficulty saying that word, but the concept of being able to move effortlessly and frictionlessly between chains in a secure and economically feasible way. And Eitan is building a protocol that aims to achieve that. But today's discussion will be a broader discussion on why this is useful and why people are interested in developing such technology. So Eitan, first, if you don't mind just giving us a little bit about your background, how you ended up here, how you ended up in DeFi and in crypto. You've been around software and technology for a very long time. So I'm sure the audience will be interested to hear your perspective in terms of your journey.
Yeah, thank you. So great being here. So yeah, my journey starts way back. In fact, I think we have to go back 35 years. That's before even many of your viewers were even born. And I started my career as a developer. I got drafted to the Israeli army and got trained to be a developer. And that was basically my service. And that gave me a very interesting perspective on development of mission critical systems. Very, very interesting period of time. And after that, I switched to other roles in the tech industry. This is where I've been my whole life. I did professional services, product management, marketing, and even I helped Hewlett Packard establish their global incubator. So I created a system for innovation management in a large corporate. So that gave me a very broad perspective of not only the industry, but also the roles within the industry. And I think these are the roots for everything that we're doing today with Kima.
Right. And what was the impetus for you to move from the corporate establishment, places like HP, which I think you were there for 5 or 6 years? So you established a career in that world. What was the impetus for you to start thinking about blockchains and cryptocurrencies and then moving to the point where you're now founding a project and looking to expand further into that wilderness?
Yeah. So even when I was with large corporates, you mentioned HP, that was one, but I've been in several such large establishments. Even then, I always got attracted to the cutting edge technologies and business models. Technology alone didn't cut it for me. I was always looking for this triangle of technology, business or economic models, and people. So this triangle really defines everything that I did. the blockchain innovation, the DLT, and the initial white paper that was written by Satoshi Nakamoto, that really is the perfect incarnation of this triangle, right? We're talking about a technology solving a problem in the economic and business world and with a direct impact on people. And that really, when I read it first, it blew my mind, like many others. Wow, this is a disruption that I've never seen, that kind of disruption that would, if successful, would impact on lives. And that was the thinking when I got into crypto back in 2013. I thought that, hey, this is so powerful, I must try it. And what could you do in 2013? You basically had Bitcoin, not much else. But what can you do with these assets? You can buy, hold, and sell, right? So this is what I tried doing. I opened a Coinbase account and I tried buying some Bitcoin and selling some Bitcoin to get a sense of, okay, I need to understand how this whole thing works. And my experience wasn't very good. The people part wasn't very developed back then. Technology was there. The promise for the economics were there, but the people, the user experience was very bad. And that was the first challenge that I wanted to solve. So with two friends, we decided to create a wallet that will be user-friendly. It will be very easy, straightforward to operate it, and will be very secure. One of the problems, and that goes back to the experience, was that you felt scared if you held your Bitcoin on a wallet on your phone. That was scary, right? What if someone steals your phone or you drop it somewhere? So that's a scary experience. Add to that the fact that these wallets weren't very user-friendly. That's really scary. So our wallet was friendly, and it allowed a way to back up your private keys in a secure manner on external devices. So in fact, that was 2014. In fact, I think we were one of the first hardware wallets or cold wallets that ever existed. It was an open source project entirely for the good of the community. It wasn't a startup with commercial intentions. And we were all very proud in that wallet. Obviously, then came the likes of Ledger and Trezor, who solved that problem in a more, I would say, robust way.
Right. And over this 35-year career of developing technology, whether it's for government entities or large corporations, or in an open source manner, as you've just described, where do you think we are in that kind of an adoption curve where in your mind, you've seen things come together? You referenced the triangle. You've seen the other side of that equation. You've seen when it works and you've seen when it doesn't work. And naturally, there's a journey to get there. So where do you think we are currently as it relates specifically to DeFi along that curve, and maybe use that as the introduction to potentially talking about interoperability as being one of the obstacles that's not yet solved along that adoption
curve? Yeah. So with all the uniqueness and the special attributes that we see in this kind of a disruptive technology, we also see some commonalities. And when I do my own analysis based on my own personal experience, and I look back 35 years, so let's think for a second, what happened in the past 35 years. So when I got initially trained as a developer, we had mainframe systems, and we were just switching into what back then we used to call mini computers. So they are like mainframe systems, but distributed. So, and the mainframe system, by the way, we had the concept of virtual machines. We talked today about EVMs, but we had virtual machines that lived within a huge mainframe computer. And it's interesting to go back to these models because we see a lot of the evolution that today we see in the crypto and blockchain space. We've seen it before. Also, the evolution of the business models. So in a mainframe, there was one entity running this huge mainframe system, and you used to pay for the commodities, for the resources that you consumed. So you paid for compute, you paid for storage, and you paid for network. Does that sound familiar? So in a way, we think, sometimes we tend to think that we invented everything, but in fact, you can see technology really rhymes in its adoption curves. And then from this one singular entity, this mainframe that provides compute, network, and storage services to its users, we started to distribute the mainframe, the compute power, to smaller pieces. Initially, those were the mini computers, and then we we saw the introduction of this, the personal computer. So we've seen the transition from a central compute power into smaller pieces. You can think about it like shards, as we speak about them today. And every PC had its own set of resources, the compute power, the CPU, and the storage, and no need for network. And then we started to see those silos, right? So if I was an accountant, I had my PCs in my office, and then we saw the LAN, the local area network, where those PCs in the office got connected. But what happens if this accountant, the software needs to communicate with another accountant? And so we started seeing those wide area networks, the ones, and then came the internet that really connected everything. So even then we saw intranets that were permissioned networks, permissioned internets, and then the internet itself. And there was a competition, there was a race between intranets and internets, and nobody knew who will win. But eventually what really won was the openness. And we've seen this again and again. We've seen this with the evolution of the computer, as I just mentioned. We've seen this when the internet got introduced and opened. So we've seen AOL. Does anyone really think about AOL anymore? AOL was a walled garden. It was an internet within the internet, and it was permissioned, but it didn't survive. We've seen the mobile systems. Do you recall the Nokia phones that were closed ecosystems? If you wanted to introduce an application for a Nokia phone, you had to go through the vendor and the carrier that needed to give you permission and approve you. And all of that was gone because there was a better system, an open system. And what's even more important, or equally important, is composability. What that means is that you don't need to reinvent everything, the entire stack. If there's a network, if there's a transport layer, you can use it. If it's open, you can use it. TCP/IP is open, right? Everyone can use it. And then you can build on top of it. So you can build the next layer in the stack. So then there is an application layer. And if it's open, then people can build the applications on top of it. So this is how we see the evolution. So the commonality here is that within this evolution, we see first the walled gardens, those closed ecosystems, because they're centered around an entity that is innovative. It really provides a lot of value for its ecosystem. But the open ecosystem will always prevail. That's my own assumption. And this is why I'm so enthusiastic about the open protocols. So if we will continue looking at blockchains, and now I'm making this connection to what I learned in those 35 years. So blockchains can be siloed and they can create ecosystems of their own. But the openness will prevail because there will always be, in my mind, a reason for a specific blockchain. It may be more secure. It may have a better user experience for some reasons. TPS may be higher. Maybe the language, smart contract languages, will be more easier to use and friendly. There are many reasons why we see so many blockchains, and that will continue. But the thing is that we will see the Netscapeization of the blockchain space, where there will be those layers that will make them interoperable. And this is why I see the importance of interoperability. In order to prevail, these silos need to be able to communicate, transfer value, share data in order to really survive.
Right. So hearing you talk about that, but it sounds inevitable. And I also share that view, by the way, that we will live in you can say multi-chain world, and that might mean 12 blockchains. I think there'll be hundreds, if not thousands, each of them with their own specific use case that will appeal to a specific niche or segment of the user base. It could be every game has its own chain, and that alone will spawn up thousands of these chains. So the idea of a world where that isn't a thing, to me, seems very naive. So assuming that is the world that we will be living in, then the interoperability component or layer is critical to allowing us to interact with all these blockchains how we see fit in a way that is easy and secure. Now, I say secure because you can move assets and tokens between blockchains today. There's the two major ways of doing it is using a bridge and wrap tokens. And as we know, that doesn't work very well. Insecure a week ago. I can't really count the days anymore. There's so much action going on, but probably a week ago, $200 million was stolen from the Nomad Bridge. We know the Ronin Bridge got exploded for, I think, $600 million, which was associated with the Axie Infinity game. These are very, very, very large numbers. In fact, numbers that are large enough that it can really put a dent into adoption in the crypto ecosystem as a whole. I think, and maybe you gave me this stat last week when we chatted, I think it's about $1.9 billion value that's been lost in bridge attacks. Mm-hmm. Is that this year? Is that year today?
Yeah, it's in the past year, yeah.
Great. So we've got another 4 months left in the year. So let's extrapolate that out to say $3 billion will be lost this year. So they're very, very big numbers. Now, let's just get our definitions right here. And feel free to give a technical definition if you like, but also a more colloquial definition around DLT interoperability. So distributed ledger technology interoperability. What do you mean by that in a technical sense?
Yeah. So in my mind, the way I see it, there are three things that should be interoperable or be reflected in interoperability. One is general messages, the ability, what we call remote procedural calls, RPC, the ability to invoke functionality remotely from one blockchain to the other. If we translate it to the terms that we know, so if you want to run a smart contract on a remote blockchain because you need some functionality that resides on a remote chain, that's one thing. So the way we do it for decades now is we send a message remotely in a secured manner from one ecosystem to the other through protocols that enable that, and that is the RPC. So if we take it back to the world that we know, let's say that you're an airline ticketing system and you want, for your customer, you want to ticket a connecting flight with a partner airline. It's a different system and you want to invoke a workflow on this remote system to ticket the ticket on this connecting flight and give you the approval with all the information, the metadata, like the ticket reservation number and so on. So that is the equivalent. So you want to be able to invoke functionality remotely because not everything will be in your own blockchain.
Right.
That's the first part. The second part is the ability to share data. So that's not really invoking those, but you want to tap into data pools or data sets that reside elsewhere. Again, we can think about these in the non-blockchain space. We do it all the time, right? Netflix wants to approve that you have, I don't know, approval from the credit card company that your credit card is okay. So there is some kind of need to tap into a database, a data pool, a data set.
By APIs or some other method.
Exactly. Yeah. And the third thing, which is the part that we decided to solve, is liquidity. And that is unique to financial systems. This is not a generic problem. And the way we see it is a very specific problem. And that is the need to enable what we call heterogeneous transactions. So we're talking about financial transactions. It could be payment. It could be any type of financial transaction that has multiple, not only sometimes two, sometimes more legs in multiple ecosystems. So the most, you mentioned bridges, a bridge is one application to these heterogeneous transactions. So a bridge moves value from one chain to the other. But let's talk about other use cases, which are similar, but not identical. Let's say that you're an NFT marketplace. So let's say that you run it on Solana, and you know that many of your potential users or even existing users, they have assets on Ethereum or Polygon or Avalanche or Phantom or Cardano, whatever. So instead of just limiting yourself to the Solana hardcore users, why not open it up and enable a transaction that is sourced from another chain in order to buy this NFT on your Solana-based NFT marketplace? So there is a need to be able to settle heterogeneous cross-chain transactions. And that is the third part of interoperability, because DeFi and financial, the crypto space, we base a lot of the functionality on the tokens, on the assets. So we cannot really distinguish between, in many cases, between functionality and the assets. And that is why the third part is so crucial for the mass adoption of the crypto space.
It's interesting that you note that there are these three buckets of interoperability that are critical, and each requires its own separate solution. Trying to do them all at once seems to be a silly proposition. So you founded this company, Kima Finance, and you're going to focus on the liquidity component, which essentially means being able to move value from one blockchain to another that most of us have either done or are doing very actively for various different reasons. Now, why is DLT interoperability, as it relates to the liquidity, which you're very familiar with, why is it such a difficult problem to execute against? And this is my assumption that it's difficult, only because no one has solved it yet. It seems to be a very lucrative business to be in. If you have a business that can solve this, I think at that point it's game over because of the extreme value that that business will hold. No one's been able to do it. I'm aware of ThoughtChain that seems to be trying to solve the same problem set that you've been discussing in a different way. So I do know a little bit about the difficulties they've gone through over the last 4 years to get there. But why is it a difficult problem to solve? And this may be a very deeply technical question. I don't know. But if you could educate us a little bit as to why this hasn't been nailed yet.
Yeah. So that's a great question. We got into this challenge because we had it. By the way, we started our company with a completely different premise. We wanted to provide a set of tools that would help institutions manage their financial risks. And one of the challenges that we had is if we wanted to provide such tools on the Solana chain for, and we used derivatives, we used the future contracts and options, and these primitives are not in existence in the Solana ecosystem. So we needed to import them or use them on the Ethereum ecosystem. And then we started to see, okay, how are we going to do it? And we looked at the, and we asked ourselves, why is it so difficult? Why we cannot do it? And there are multiple challenges. First and foremost, security. That is obviously whenever we see a hack, and unfortunately we see them every few weeks, that is another proof of the security of interoperability is a big challenge. And the reason is that there are many moving parts in those solutions. Essentially, regardless of what type of solution, and there are multiple types or approaches, they are based on smart contracts. Some of them are based on oracles and relayers, and they're based on access to keys in order to move around liquidity between vaults or pools. So all these things that I just counted are attack surface areas. And this is a big problem to solve, these attack surface areas. How do you handle smart contracts vulnerabilities? So hopefully you program them well with good practices, and then you audit them. And we've seen that many of these hacks happened to smart contracts that were audited by the best auditors in the world. And there's probably, whenever a human being is programming a program, there is a chance that another human being will find bugs or loopholes or backdoors in the code. So whether we like it or not, computer software is vulnerable and hackable. And then we need to see how we address these vulnerabilities. So solving this problem requires a lot of knowledge in security, and not only, by the way, cybersecurity. We've also seen attacks on the financial side. So you really need to understand the mechanics of a token and the potential ways to attack the way the token works from the financial aspect. So it's a really multidisciplinary challenge.
I'll also add one more, but there are social attacks. I think the way that Axie, the Ronin Bridge happened, was social engineering by accessing a particular individual's home computer via some kind of elaborate scheme, phishing scheme, to offer them a job where they set up a fake company with a fake LinkedIn account. And so these are very sophisticated actors. So you've got the cybersecurity attack vector, you've got understanding the financial implications of how all of that value flows through, because if you've got enough money, you can brute force your way into a certain system. But then you also need to hedge for the stupidity of humans. Well, that's probably a harsh way of saying it, but the vulnerability of humans in being susceptible to attacks via a social construct. So hearing you explain all that, That just seems like an absolute nightmare to try and hedge against all of those things. So I'll let you continue about maybe talking about what kind of construct you guys are trying to build to ensure that the surface area is as limited as possible.
Yeah. So, and just to continue what you just said, this is such a complicated problem that we think there are two things that need to happen. One, you need to be an expert in what you do. That implies that you do one thing and one thing only in order to really close all these holes in the potential attack vectors. And the second thing is don't try to generalize. And that is related also to the first. So we decided intentionally to build a protocol that is optimized for this problem and this problem only. We may expand and extend it to additional challenges in the future, but that's the future. Right now, we want to optimize everything we do for this challenge of heterogeneous cross-chain transactions. That means that we're not about doing exchanges. We're not about sending messages between blockchains because these are more generic problems. And we want to really solve, we want to be this settlement layer, which on top of it, maybe new use cases will emerge. So how do we do it? How do we eliminate many or some of these vulnerabilities? So I mentioned the big problem of smart contracts. And just the one that we saw last week, Nomad, was a smart contract hack. It was following an upgrade, by the way. And that is one of the problems with smart contracts. If you develop them well and you audit them, you go through 5 audits and then you test them and you deploy them on the multiple networks and then you upgrade them. You do some kind of a very small upgrade. And being a developer, I remember so many bugs that everyone, including myself, had let into a system in a very minor upgrade. Because the more minor it is, the more confidence you have
right. That
it's yep. The right code. It's so minor, nothing will happen. And in the Nomad attack, if I recall well, it was the initiation of the variable that held the address, which was 0x000, which was a valid address instead of an invalid address. So when everyone had this kind of initiation, it was a valid transaction, and then you could change the target, the wallet, and it was a looting kind of event. So the problem with software is that you always upgrade and you always maintain it, and it's an endless cycle. So we, in our case, we thought, what will happen if we eliminate the need for a smart contract altogether? There is and I mentioned that I have some experience in innovation management. There's a technique in innovation ideation that's called abstraction. And that is a technique where you think in the ideation process, what will happen if I eliminate a core component of this product? So the elder viewers recall the VCR. The old VCRs, those video recorders, they had all these panels with so many buttons on them. And the latest models before this whole thing evaporated, where they were just a plain box with a place to put the CD in and everything was on a remote. This is abstraction because the whole panel was so cumbersome and nobody knew how to operate it. I recall my parents calling me, asking me, okay, how do I program it to record this program? So we eliminated, gave away the need for smart contracts. And how can you attack a smart contract if there isn't one? So that's one example for, and that obviously we can do it only because we solve a specific problem. If you need a generic protocol that solves liquidity and data and messages, then you must have smart contracts. But if you're only solving the liquidity part, there is a way to do it without smart contracts. And that's exactly what we did. So that's one example for the innovation in what we do. For the security part, we have several layers of security. Some of them are very technical, but just to list a few, we also address some of the risk, the collusion risk and the Sybil attacks risks when you run a chain. So we address that with another novel approach where we split our consensus mechanism into two types. One is permissioned and the other is permissionless. So we take basically the best of both worlds in order to create a unique consensus mechanism that requires consensus in each tier, but then between the tiers. It's like, I think of a governmental system in a nation. You have the broader parliament that is broad and it creates the laws. And then there's the government that needs to execute and it has to execute, but there's also the judicial system. If a law is unlawful, it can
enforce
or even cancel a law. So these are balances and controls we implemented in our multi-tier consensus mechanism. And the third example for the security layers that I wanted to mention is a hardware part, and that is SGX. So we did not invent it. We're using Intel SGX, which protocols like Avalanche and the Secret Network are using, but we're using it for this purpose where there are enclaves that run on the processor part, on the hardware part. And that means that in order to hack into that, you really need access to the hardware, to the node itself. Again, this is not, I would never say that this is hacker proof, but every layer that we add creates a more unlikely attack because you have to go through all these layers of security in order to get access to the keys.
I apologize for the interruption, folks. If you enjoy the discussions that we have on this podcast, please consider leaving a review on whatever podcast platform you're using. If you're watching on YouTube, then please like the video and subscribe to the channel. Getting reviews helps the podcast reach more users and has the added benefit of spurring me on to make more content. Thank you, and now let's get back to the discussion. Yeah. The risk associated with bridged and wrapped tokens seems to be that there's so many moving parts, as you've very eloquently described. Trying to minimize that surface area using the techniques and the strategies that you've discussed. But what came to mind is the trade-off that we face and that developers and teams like yourself faces around security and decentralization, right? Subtracting the need for smart contracts, adding a hardware component and these layers of security seems to be, well, that adds a centralized component. How do you view that game between the difficult decisions that need to be made around security, but then most of those discussions end up, well, if we siloed this thing and didn't make it decentralized, we could make it really, really secure. Your protocol's not live. People haven't played with it yet. So it's still in the development phase. There's no token or anything like that. This is more of an intellectual discussion about the problems and some of an approach to the solutions. But internally and also personally for yourself, do you feel like the protocols and the blockchains that will gain mass adoption looking ahead 3, 5, 7 years into the future, will have the most secure ones will have centralized components because of the reasons that you've outlined? And not a discussion around whether that's right or wrong, just is that where we're headed?
Yeah, so I'm not a big fan of maximalism of any type. I drank the Kool-Aid many years ago, you know, and I believe in the decentralization narrative and the sovereignty and non-custodial systems.
As do I.
And this is the Shangri-La. But we know that the Shangri-La doesn't exist. This is something we can aspire for. It's a good model to have. It's a good vision to have. But we need to optimize or balance the trade-offs. And what we're trying to do is to strike a balance between decentralization. And we have to also remember, why are we after decentralization? So decentralization means that there is no one single point of failure. It means that there's no censorship. It means several things. So just the flag or the banner of decentralization, we need to unpack it sometimes and make sure that we don't hurt the things. I would even say that decentralization is a means to an end. It's not the end. It's not the objective itself. We want to create a system that is censorship resistant, that is private, that is doesn't have a single point of failure, has as one version of the truth. These are the things that we should aspire. And if we can maximize and optimize these things with some way of compromising the narrative of decentralization, I think it's, realistically speaking, it's a reasonable price to pay. And this is why when we assess our architecture, these are the questions that we ask. So we say, okay, so by introducing a permissioned tier, the permission tier is there in order to remove the risk of Sybil attacks. So is it a worthwhile price to pay? We think so, yes. And by the way, in the future, that might be optional. So if you really want to go with the 100% permissionless way, we will have liquidity pools that will not require the approval of the permissioned tier. So once you understand what you're optimizing for, then I think that the decisions, the product decisions become clearer. So if we target, and we do target financial institutions as well, they would want to know that there is a permissioned tier that would sign their multi-million transactions, because for them, this is more important than the decentralization narrative. So
I'm very well aligned with your view on things. Decentralization for the sake of it has a cost. And if that cost is the security of my hard-earned money, that is not a cost I'm willing to pay. And as a result, I jump through the hoops that Binance and FTX and other centralized entities that I trust make me jump through. I have acquaintances and friends who hold an opposite view. And in their mind, the risk of the centralized exchange doing something to affect them is greater than the risk of the security dealing with a fully decentralized workflow. So I think in the future, or even today, it's a nuanced discussion. There's a spectrum. And I think it is important, and I'm very happy to hear you say that, to address this point specifically, that users have options. And you can play anywhere you want on any point along that spectrum based on what is important to you. And if security is of paramount importance to you, like, as you correctly mentioned, financial institutions, then you can opt for a specific solution that optimizes for security. And conversely, anyone else along that spectrum can use. So I'm excited to see what that world looks like. And I think that's the right discussion to have, is at what point along that spectrum do I want to solve for, and then solve for that. You're not going to be able to have one solution that is going to solve for all of the different participants in the market. And the fact that you're already using that construct in developing your product is very, very encouraging. And I look forward to more projects thinking about it along that gradient. It's not black and white. And we've kind of been led to believe that it is black and white. Specifically, that the news today with the Tornado Cash sanctions and what that means for privacy, same thing. It is a nuanced discussion. There are trade-offs there. So look, that's a very robust way of thinking about the development of this protocol. So just to kind of summarize, we know what interoperability is, the different formats that it takes, or different buckets. We know why it's a difficult problem to execute against, which is linked to why there is so much risk associated with bridges and wrap tokens. Some of your thoughts about the approaches you might take. But if we think about the solution you're looking to build or building, it sounds like, these are your words in our previous discussion, a foundational settlement layer in the form of a utility-specific blockchain. It's only going to do this one thing. You're not going to be able to build, there won't be an ecosystem built here. There's not going to be specific DeFi project. This is a blockchain built with this one thing in mind, and that is it. Is there a chain that you feel, forget about the use case, but that fits that characteristic already live, that is a very specific utility blockchain that only does one thing? I can't think of one.
No.
Right. Okay. Most of these, well, all of these blockchains are looking to be an environment or an ecosystem where all of these things can be built on top of. Now, do you think from a technical standpoint, utility specific chains is the path of least resistance to solving? Obviously, you think it's a path to solving the problem you're looking at, but what about other problems? Do you think these blockchains are going to evolve, or new blockchains are going to be started with that in mind? That's the path of least resistance. That's how we can solve these solutions. Is that going to be a trend in your mind?
I think so, yes. And that is why we're excited about ecosystems that enable that. Cosmos is one of them. Mm-hmm. With the Cosmos SDK, this is basically the narrative behind Cosmos. Let's create, they call it app-specific chains. I call it, in our case, it's a utility. It's not an app. It's a utility that enables many apps to use that utility. And we see that in the Polkadot structure with the parachains, and now Ethereum going into sharding and roll-ups. So we're starting to see this concept emerging. And what I think the next step would be app-specific and utility-specific blockchains that specialize in one problem and doing that the best way, through a blockchain, through a token, for a proof of stake token, leveraging the capabilities that a chain would provide. And actually, we've heard recently that DYDX is moving in that direction. They're building on a Cosmos-based chain. And that may be, you ask me if I can think of another chain. This might be a good example. They're building a chain that is optimized to hold order books and exchange order books.
That's it.
Yeah. And I think it's a fantastic way of thinking of solving a problem through a blockchain just for that purpose, not thinking big, let's create an ecosystem, another language, smart contract. This is a huge project and we need the small ones. We need the specific blockchains. And I think this will enable, first of all, it will be a better solution to a very, very well-defined problem. And second, it will drive adoption because it also enables through these decisions, product decisions that founders can make, they don't need to cater for dozens of use cases. They can support just one, two, three use cases and do that the best way they can. And that will drive adoption as well.
Right. Yeah, I'm going to look into the DYDX thing because as you were talking, the implications of that and the other problems you could potentially solve or make faster or more secure are quite vast. So I'm going to do a little bit of work on that just to educate myself on what it takes to execute on something like that. And using DYDX as a use case, since they're already doing it, seems to be a worthwhile exercise. Let's talk about the concept of fragmented liquidity. So what we mean by fragmented liquidity is, as it relates to DeFi, you have these pools of liquidity of value sitting on all these different blockchains. And you can't access all of that liquidity at once. If you're on the Ethereum blockchain, you're using the liquidity that is available on Ethereum or on a protocol on Ethereum. Even protocols don't share liquidity, let alone chains sharing liquidity. And when we talk about the need for liquidity, it facilitates the efficient price discovery, exchange. So having deep liquidity, we are all familiar with why that is important. So in a world where all of this liquidity seems to be fragmented all over the place, that seems to be a problem worth solving. If we could work out a way to tap into all of that liquidity, or at least parts of that liquidity at once, and pull it together, pricing would be cheaper. You'll be able to move a lot more value a lot faster. It may lead to more adoption. So good things happen. In your view, why is that a problem worth solving? And I assume that it's a problem because of what you already outlined, is that these systems don't talk to each other. Therefore, this liquidity is kind of walled garden, held in vaults, to look, you know, for lack of a better word, that the other systems can't talk to. So why is it a problem worth solving? And as a follow-on to that, in your view, what are the implications of potentially solving that either in its entirety or in some part?
So I think the best way to answer this question is really to go back and think about us as human beings doing commerce over the years. So if we go back to ancient days, a city or a state had commerce within the boundaries of the city and the state, right? And then we started seeing those Phoenicians and the various people that became experts in moving around commodities between those countries and nations and states and cities. Why was that important and why was it beneficial? Because first, there was an arbitrage, right? Demand and supply arbitrage. If you had silk in India, people in Europe or China, people in Europe wanted that silk. So they were willing to pay a lot of money because of the scarcity. And then some silk started to move around with all these paths and routes. Fast forward to our own days. Think of e-commerce. If you serve just people, you have a website or a brick and mortar shop, you serve people in your own city, in your own vicinity. If you have a website and you ship only within your country, then you have that kind of addressable market. Now, before e-commerce, before the internet, that was given. But when commerce became global, really global, now you could open up your business to people in other countries and ship your products to other countries and dramatically, significantly expand your addressable market and your business with sometimes several orders of magnitude. And that is the promise here. If we create real interoperability, we create businesses that are not constrained by technical constraints, which are the blockchain that you've chose to develop on. Now, all of a sudden, you can reach out to people that use other products, other services on other chains. They have liquidity on other chains, and now they can use your product regardless of where their money resides. And we've seen this, again, a long history. We've seen this with the internet and e-commerce, global e-commerce. And I'm sure that with the right settlement layers, like the ones we're trying to build, we will see this happening in the blockchain space. In other words, the selection of the chain will get abstracted by the functionality. You have a functionality that is compelling. It doesn't matter where you chose to build upon. Those were technical decisions that you made at the get-go. That doesn't need to impact your business, doesn't need to impact your potential customer base. This abstraction, I think, will drive adoption, because now the question would be, okay, which service would I use? If there is a game on a chain that I don't have assets today, I can still use it. I can still use this Web3 app, regardless of which ecosystem they chose to build. They chose to build on Avalanche because of the throughput, number of transactions per second, and gas costs. But I'm an Ethereum user. I want to use that. I want to play that game. Why can't I do it in a transparent manner? With this settlement layer, we abstract away these limitations from liquidity perspective.
Yeah, so it goes above and beyond. In my mind, it was liquidity gives me best prices, better prices. So I'm a trader. But the way that you're explaining it seems to be that it widens the potential universe for any particular product or service. But as you said, abstracting the chain from the equation. Very, very similar and analogous to your historical perspective of global trade via shipping around the world. It increases the total addressable market for the thing you've built, which reduces marketing costs, which increases adoption very quickly. And also, it sounds like it would be a much better experience and an easier experience than what we have to do now. You need to bridge assets, and you need to go here, and you need to go there. You need to type in, get the right RPC, and like familiarize yourself with that chain. It is not cumbersome. It is a body of work that you need to conduct before you interact on a new chain. I mean, at least I do. I need to learn about the chain. Who built it? What are the vulnerabilities? So it's a body of work for me to interact with a protocol on another chain. And in the world that you're describing, I won't need to do any of that work. I can use a settlement layer and have access to all of these different worlds or chains. I like to think of them as worlds, in a very frictionless way. And in the implications of that, fantastic. Above and beyond saving 20 basis points on a swap. Right, right. So universal liquidity, a world with universal liquidity is, yeah, you're right, orders of magnitude more exciting and has more activity than we currently have. It may also result, and some people might view this as a negative, I see it as a positive, but it will result in some consolidation, right? Weak DEXs on a chain are just not going to make it. I actually think that's a good thing, because it results in a better product for me to use. Similar to the e-commerce model, right? A lot of people said, well, being able to ship globally will hurt independent retailers. Well, if independent retailers are poor operators, then the natural order of things is they will eventually go out of business as transactions and value flows through to the businesses that have the best product at the best price with the best service. And as a result, you end up with Amazon. Again, I think that's a positive. I use Amazon. Can't really use it in Cyprus where I am because they don't serve Cyprus, but in Australia and when I lived in Spain, it's fantastic. So I think it makes commerce and activity in this new world that we're trying to build much more efficient and increases the speed of adoption. Now, on the website for Kima Finance and in some of our previous discussion, we didn't really get to this, but it seems to be that the implication of the ability to merge or access off-chain liquidity and have it tap into on-chain liquidity. So I don't know how you plan to do this, and I don't really know of a lot of solutions that even attempt this, but how do you think these pathways for on-chain and off-chain liquidity to come together to, again, accelerate adoption, both from a pricing perspective, but also increasing the total addressable market, et cetera, et cetera. Talk to me a little bit about that, please.
Yeah. So there are two ways to look at it, bottom up and top down. From top down, this is really part of our vision. The vision, by building this interoperable global settlement layer, we think of smooth fluid, seamless transition of assets, of any asset class,
okay,
from one place to the other in a programmatic way. And just as an example, we're used to think in terms of siloed asset classes, right? I can own real estate. I can own future contracts on oil barrels. I can own an Amazon share. I can own Bitcoin, or I can own some deposits, cash deposits in the bank. So these are various, or create debt. These are various asset classes. And if I want to switch between one asset class to the other, I have to go through one or several mediators. If I have the Amazon share and I want to buy Bitcoin, I have to go to an exchange, sell it for my base currency, let's say US dollars, move that from this amount from my broker account into my bank account, from that bank account, move it to my exchange, and then buy Bitcoin and store it, and then get my Bitcoin into my wallet. So what if we could simply transition from one asset class to the other? And when you think about it, this is part of the promise of tokenization, because a token is divisible, is fungible, is easy to mobilize. And if you could do everything in non-custodial way, where you're the owner of the token that represents the Amazon share in your own wallet, and then you just switch it to Bitcoin, how fantastic that would be. So the entire financial world will be streamlined. You will be able to move around assets between asset classes and all these silos that we're so used to think about. So that's the grand vision. And when you take it down to earth, so we're thinking about these silos. So how can we realize that vision? We can realize it by starting to connect, plug in these worlds that are so disconnected today. So if we solve the interoperability problem within blockchains through a decentralized settlement layer, why can't we now use the same settlement layer also to settle cash, fiat money, CBDCs, maybe in the future other tokenized assets? So the way we work is that we use liquidity pools. So for us, technically speaking, if we plug into our system a liquidity pool that is holding USDC on Polygon, technically speaking, it's the same as creating a liquidity pool holding US dollars that is in custody of a bank, and then do this settlement in the same way. So that's the plan for next year. The challenge is not, once we have the settlement, there is not a technical challenge. It's a regulatory compliance, legal challenge. And we are working on that. Thank God we have lawyers and banks and the service providers that, once we manage to build this framework, a legal framework, technically speaking, it's a no-brainer.
It's fascinating stuff. And I like the way that you frame the discussion around this is the grand vision. This is what we would like to happen. But at the same time, I'm a realist. I need to come back down to earth and then operate within the real world, which I think, and I see it changing slightly, at least over the last 6 months, but I think the crypto industry suffered a little bit about playing in the clouds for too much. Naturally, you need the vision to drive that innovation, but spending 80% of people's time in the clouds and only 20% of it with your hands in the dirt just seemed to me to be not only the wrong approach, but incredibly silly and stupid. So again, encouraged with your take on that, and understanding that that's probably a long way away. And you correctly outlined, it's not a tech challenge, it's a compliance and regulatory challenge. Because great, press a button, go from USDC to a share of Amazon to Bitcoin. Great. Well, how do you tax that, right? And so there's all of these peripheral questions and problems to solve, which aren't really in our hands. There needs to be some clarity from regulators. Look, we've been talking for a while, but I want to give you some time to talk about where Kima currently stands in the development cycle. I know that you recently raised a small seven-figure amount, so congratulations on that. I want to eagerly follow your progress, because it sounds like your views are very aligned with my views and that you seem to have the skill set to possibly pull this off. So let's talk a little bit around what development looks like today, what the timeline might look like. Again, there's nothing to invest in right now, so I'm happy to have that discussion with you and just give people an idea of when something like this might be live and how they might participate if they choose to.
Yeah, absolutely. So we have very aggressive targets. We are now in a private testnet. That means that we have the basic consensus mechanism developed and we're testing it. At the same time, in parallel, we're developing several other modules modules. We did not talk about one key module that we have, and that is a liquidity management balancing algorithm. That's a bit technical, but we have several pillars to our architecture that we develop in parallel, and we're looking into integrating everything into a single testnet. That's planned for October. And at that point, this will start our beta phase where we are going to test our system along with early adopter Web3 developers and builders. So the way to participate is really to talk to us, work with us. We're not selling anything. We're not pushing anything. We just want to work with early adopters and that will contribute their requirements and help us with the backlog and our roadmap building. And the main first version of the mainnet is planned probably beginning of next year. So that's from a development point of view. And we are looking for Web3 builders and financial institutions interested in taking part of this journey and basically work with us together. We have a foundation that is responsible for developing the protocol and anyone who finds interest in the vision and the approach that we're taking is welcome to reach out to us and even join the foundation and take part in the governance of this whole thing.
Great. I'm certainly excited about the implications. It seems that that is a noble pursuit, but also a highly lucrative pursuit. I think whatever companies can contribute to solving this problem are going to make a lot of money. And the reason they make a lot of money is that it is these things, these solutions will be core infrastructure to everything else, right? It will be the picks and the shovels in the gold rush. So from an investment standpoint and a business standpoint, I think there'll be a lot of funding thrown at these kinds of problems. And I'm certainly going to follow it very closely. Is there anything that we haven't touched on or that we have touched on that you think is misunderstood by the market or that you would like to put more emphasis on? Anything in that category that you think we should revisit or you'd like to introduce as we wrap up here?
No, I think we covered the major things that I wanted to talk about. It was important for me to provide some kind of historic perspective. One of my messages is that, yes, it's cutting edge and we're doing new things, but a lot of it really rhymes with things we've seen and solved in the past. And following those footsteps of the past, both in the tech industry, the financial industry, and the social aspects, you know, will help us do things properly and not do the same mistakes as others did in the past. So this is how we try to look at things and at the same time really innovate with the technology and build a solution that is novel. And again, it's a matter of, I still think that there's a factor of community participation. It's like the wallet that we built. It was with the community, for the community. We are not going to solve everything by ourselves. And this is why I'm really happy that we see the interest in the various ecosystems. And I call really all builders to join us and take part in this effort.
Yeah, I really appreciate your historical perspective and the way you explain things with that perspective in mind. It's not only instructive around what might happen and what some of these outcomes might look like, but it's also very helpful to me to understand what the discussion should be and how to frame it in my mind around some of these complex technical issues, the thinking about an analogous period or an analogous situation that is easier to understand makes it very easy for me to get there. So look, I really thank you for your time. It's been a fantastic discussion, very educational, and I wish you the best of luck in your endeavors trying to solve these problems. And as I said, I'll be monitoring it closely.
Thank you. Thank you, Nick, for giving me this opportunity. I really enjoyed the conversation and hope to let's stay in touch.
Will do.